Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast, where leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. In this episode, Dr. James F. Howard, Professor of Neurology, Medicine, and Allied Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, reviews the state of the science regarding generalized myasthenia gravis evaluation and management. He shares the role of both traditional therapies and newer classes of agents, including complement inhibitors and FcRn inhibitors. Woven throughout his commentary, he highlights the illness burden and challenges that patients with the disease face, as well as challenges to address those changes and improve patient care and outcomes.
Thank you for being here today, Dr. Howard.
Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, I'll start by asking you to describe the illness burden associated with generalized myasthenia gravis.
Myasthenia gravis has a tremendous burden. When we talk about burdens of disease, the results of the weakness, the double vision, et cetera, and we also talk about treatment burden, which is primarily related to the adverse events of the therapeutics that we use. The burden of disease is quite varied. And as we know, myasthenia has been labeled the snowflake disease because while there are common themes, each individual is unique to themselves as to what their disabilities are related to the disorder that they have. In some individuals, it predominates with ocular symptomatology, double vision, and clearly affects the individual, for instance, who's working at a computer all day or doing numbers as an accountant. And then there are those who have significant weakness in the limbs, and so impairing the individual who is a workman in some trade that requires carrying, lifting, et cetera. But there's also other burdens of the disease that have sort of remained in the darkness over the last years. And it's only recently, as we've delved into health economic data, that they've come forth. For instance, in Japan, nearly a third of patients have trouble keeping a job because of their weakness, and many more have a reduction in their salaried income such that there may be difficulties caring for their family because of lost wages. In Thailand, over 54% of patients are unemployed because of myasthenia. In Australia, it's the high 30s, mid 40%, and many more have significant time off from work. In the US, we don't have good data due to our fractionated healthcare system, and so we can't pull it all together. But it's a huge societal cost that these folks bear because of their weakness. And then there's the burden of treatment. We all are well aware of corticosteroids, for instance, and the change in body figurement, the change in psyche, in their mood, to say nothing of the probability of diabetes or hypertension or bone health impairment. And with some of our other non-steroidal immune suppressive drugs, azathioprine, et cetera, cutaneous cancers, the renal disease that may be associated with the cyclophilin family, and diabetes with tacrolimus that may occur. We've borrowed all of our therapeutics to date from our transplant colleagues. They're very broad in their action, and as a result, there are a lot of off-target side effects. With the advent of new therapeutics, what we call targeted therapies, the culture is changing. As clinicians who treat myasthenia on a daily basis, we now want our patients to be symptom-free and to have minimal to no adverse events, class one or less, if you will. And so we've come through a revolution. Prior to this, we really didn't, it wasn't in our forefront of consciousness, so to speak, because we didn't have much to offer. And now with choice, patient choice, we now have to start considering all of these burdens that are related to the disease and to its therapy, and then make wise decision based on shared decision-making.
Thank you for being here today, Dr. Howard.
Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, I'll start asking you to describe the illness burden associated with generalized myasthenia gravis.
Myasthenia gravis has a tremendous burden. When we talk about burdens of disease, the results of the weakness, the double vision, etc., and we also talk about treatment burden, which is primarily related to the adverse events of the therapeutics that we use. The burden of disease is quite varied. And as we know, myasthenia has been labeled the snowflake disease because while there are common themes, each individual is unique to themselves as to what their disabilities are related to the disorder that they have. In some individuals, it predominates with ocular symptomatology, double vision, and clearly affects the individual, for instance, who's working at a computer all day or doing numbers as an accountant. And then there are those who have significant weakness in the limbs, and so impairing the individual who is a workman in some trade that requires carrying, lifting, etc. But there's also other burdens of the disease that have sort of remained in the darkness over the last years. And it's only recently, as we've delved into health economic data, that they've come forth. For instance, in Japan, nearly a third of patients have trouble keeping a job because of their weakness, and many more have a reduction in their salaried income such that there may be difficulties caring for their family because of lost wages. In Thailand, over 54% of patients are unemployed because of myasthenia. In Australia, it's the high 30s, mid 40%, and many more have significant time off from work. In the US, we don't have good data due to our fractionated healthcare system, and so we can't pull it all together. But it's a huge societal cost that these folks bear because of their weakness. And then there's the burden of treatment. We all are well aware of corticosteroids, for instance, and the change in body figurement, the change in psyche, in their mood, to say nothing of the probability of diabetes or hypertension or bone health impairment. And with some of our other nonsteroidal immune suppressive drugs, azathioprine, etc., cutaneous cancers, the renal disease that may be associated with the cyclophilin family and diabetes with tacrolimus that may occur. We've borrowed all of our therapeutics to date from our transplant colleagues. They're very broad in their action, and as a result, there are a lot of off-target side effects. With the advent of new therapeutics, what we call targeted therapies, the culture is changing. As clinicians who treat myasthenia on a daily basis, we now want our patients to be symptom-free and to have minimal to no adverse events, class one or less, if you will. And so we've come through a revolution. Prior to this, we really didn't, it wasn't in our forefront of consciousness, so to speak, because we didn't have much to offer. And now with choice, patient choice, we now have to start considering all of these burdens that are related to the disease and to its therapy, and then make wise decision based on shared decision making.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Howard. That's a great commentary, and I think it really sets up why we really care about this illness and why we want to talk about some of the newer things that are available in our armamentarium to treat it. To our listeners, most of our discussion today will focus on treatment, but want to briefly mention diagnosis because it starts with detection. Dr. Howard, would you say that one of the biggest challenges that neurologists face in diagnosing this disorder is just basically having the clinical suspicion that it may be there, given that it's rare?
You're absolutely correct. If one doesn't think about myasthenia gravis, you'll never consider it in your differential diagnosis. And realize that unless one is at a major neuromuscular center, the probability of seeing patients with myasthenia gravis on a fairly frequent basis is very far and few between. Many medical students and other clinicians who don't go into neurology may have never seen a case of myasthenia gravis. I remember during my early formative years in medicine, it wasn't until I was a resident in neurology that I saw a case of myasthenia gravis. So I went through medical school. I went through an intern. Well, I may have seen one as an intern, but probably only one. And it wasn't until I was a resident in neurology, because I was in a center that had a focus on myasthenia, that I saw the disease. So unless we think about it, clinicians, not only neurologists, but more importantly, the family practitioner, the internist, even to some degree, the ophthalmologist, may not consider the diagnosis. It's much like taking your car to the service station with a squeak. And when you get there, there is no squeak. And similarly, patients who come to clinic, particularly if it's earlier in the day, when they're feeling refreshed, when they're feeling rested, may not manifest any of the symptoms of myasthenia. And because it's often described as the hidden disease, it's fatigable muscle weakness made worse by activity, improved with rest, only to recur when that activity resumes. And unless you have overt ptosis or overt misalignment of the eyes, there is no real outward manifestation of the disease, thus magnifying the difficulty in recognizing it and putting it in one's differential diagnosis.
Thank you, Dr. Howard. Let's move on to disease pathophysiology. Remind us of the processes at play and the illness that cause the disease symptoms. Importantly, these are the processes that we want to target as we seek to treat the disorder.
The pathophysiology of myasthenia is unique. There's not one mechanism of disease. There are actually three that we know about, and probably more behind the scenes that we've yet to uncover. Two of these processes are related directly to antibody, and one to our complement part of the immune system. We always think about myasthenia gravis as antibody-mediated. An antibody binding to the acetylcholine receptor or some epitope on the receptor protein sterically hinders the binding of neurotransmitter acetylcholine to the receptor docking site. The immunoglobulin molecule, the IgG molecule, is huge, and it sticks its tail out into the wind, so to speak, and then blocks the transmitter getting to this docking site. Very rarely is there antibody targeting the docking site itself. It's more of a steric hindrance, if you will. The receptor protein has two docking sites for acetylcholine, and both must be occupied for that ionic channel to open and allow flux of cations that then promote the depolarization of the membrane to the action potential threshold and contraction of the muscle fiber itself. If one or none of those docking sites are available, then that channel stays closed. And it's a matter of numbers. We have more than enough receptors. We call this a safety factor for depolarization to occur. But as the disease progresses, as the antibody load blocks these receptors, fewer and fewer are available for occupancy in order to depolarize. And this is a state in flux. Antibodies are binding, unbinding all the time. And so it's sort of a moving target in the uncontrolled situation. So that's the first mechanism of disease. The second is, uniquely, that antibodies cross-link the receptors. They tie them up, if you will. And that accelerates a normal turnover process. Receptors are inserted to the membrane of the neuromuscular junction, and they have a lifespan of 7 to 10 days. And then they're internalized, degraded, and new receptors are popped to the surface. And this refreshment process keeps them sort of young and healthy, if you will. Antibody accelerates that process. And so again, we end up with a net loss of available receptors for occupancy that then reduce this safety factor that we have, ultimately leading to the inability to depolarize the membrane and get the muscle fiber to contract. And then over the last 30, 40 years, with the elegant work of Andrew Engel and his team at the Mayo Clinic, we identified that complement was at the neuromuscular junction. And then it took a while to understand this entire process. And we now recognize that antibody binding to the receptor complex activates C1q of the complement cascade. And the net result is the hyperactivity, the overexpression of the terminal complement pathway, leading to the formation of what we used to call the membrane attack complex. We now call it the terminal complement complex. It's a ring-like structure, binds to the tissue membrane, literally drills a hole through that membrane, leaks its contents, and renders it dysfunctional. It architecturally destroys the tissue itself. And this is not only true in myasthenia, where we have architectural alteration of the post-junctional folds, and if one remembers from their medical school in early training days, it goes from the peaks and valleys to a flattened rolling hill membrane. Again, the result is a net loss of available receptors for depolarization. The peak and fold aspect of the neuromuscular junction allows us to densely pack far more numbers of receptors than we need at any moment in time. And as that membrane is destroyed, there are less there. And this process also occurs in other autoimmune disorders, initially demonstrated in paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, then atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome. Now we're finding it in NMOSD, as well as many others. Now, it should be remembered that the activation of complement is dependent upon immunoglobulin G subclass 1 and 3. IgG4, which is the predominant abnormality in MuSK myasthenia, a variant of generalized myasthenia, does not activate complement. And so that mechanism is not in play in that particular subset of the disease.
Tell us about the traditional pharmacotherapies used to treat generalized myasthenia gravis and how they are best employed.
The treatment of myasthenia gravis, as I said, has been sort of borrowed from our transplantation colleagues. Yet we do have specific treatment of myasthenia gravis through the drug class cholinesterase inhibitors or acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. However, it does not treat the disease. It only treats the symptoms of muscle weakness. Cholinesterase inhibitors block the enzymatic destruction of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. It's much like if you went up to the front door, knocked on it, no one was home, you could go around to the side door or the back door. The use of cholinesterase inhibitors inhibits the enzymatic destruction of the transmitter, allowing it to hang around and act a little bit longer. From there, we have immune-specific therapies, very broad corticosteroids, non-steroidal immune suppressants, which include things like azathioprine, rituximab, mycophenolate mofetil, cyclosporine, tacrolimus. All of these have been used in treating myasthenia, broad spectrum in terms of their activity. And then we can selectively deplete B cells. We do that through drugs like rituximab, targeting CD20 signals on lymphocytes. But we can also remove the immunoglobulin and deplete IgG through things like IVIG, through plasma exchange. And then we have thymectomy. Now, it's thought that this disease originates through the misrecognition of self, a loss of tolerance, if you will, and that begins in the thymus gland. Interestingly, the thymus gland has myoid cells, and those myoid cells express acetylcholine receptors. The acetylcholine receptor is a pentamer. Four of the subunits are identical to those we see in the periphery. One is different. And it's believed by many that this one single fetal subunit is what causes the misrecognition of self, the loss of immune tolerance, and initiates the disease process. So removing the thymus gland surgically is a way to sort of turn off the disease. And it seemingly is very effective in our younger population, particularly Caucasian girls, less effective as one becomes older because the thymus gland loses its autoreactivity with aging.
So we know that we have some newer classes of therapies that are more targeted to treat the disease, and those are the complement inhibitors and the FcRn inhibitors. Dr. Howard, tell us about how the complement inhibitors work and how safe and effective they are.
As I mentioned earlier, complement was identified at the neuromuscular junction in the mid to late 1970s. And it took some 40 years to try and understand its role in myasthenia. But it was not until an antibody directed at complement, and in particular, complement protein 5, C5, that we had a potential therapeutic to treat myasthenia gravis. It had already been shown that complement inhibition to C5 was effective in paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, PNH, and atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome, AHUS, and it was decided to try it in myasthenia gravis. And so this discussion occurred in fall of 2013, or prior to that, 20, actually 2007, 2008, and then took a while to generate a protocol for it, the initial phase two trial, which demonstrated a signal and demonstrated a significant enough signal that the sponsor said, let's move on and try it in a regulatory phase three trial, which was done. And that was the start of eculizumab. Subsequent to eculizumab, we now have two others, ravulizumab and zilucoplan. Ravulizumab is actually eculizumab, but it's been genetically modified or chemically modified at four particular sites to extend its dosing half-life from every 2 weeks to every 8 weeks. But otherwise, the compound is identical. Both are administered intravenously, and as I said, target complement protein 5. Zilucoplan is different. This is a small macrocyclic peptide, only 15 amino acids. And there's some thought that this may be better than a full-size antibody in terms of getting it deeper into the tissue. It can cross basement membranes. Whether or not that has a clinical role and accounts for clinical efficacy, we really don't know. But that has been shown. But in addition to targeting C5, zilucoplan also targets C5b. So if there should be an escape, there's a secondary mechanism that will target that component. And remember, the terminal complement pathway is C5 cleaving to 5a, 5b. 5b then goes on to combine with C6, C7, C8. Multiple copies of C9 to form the ring-like pore structure that attaches to membrane, drills holes, and destroys it. The beauty of these therapies are the fact that they are targeted and the onset of effect is exceptionally rapid. Typically, our ISTs, our immune therapies that have been commonly used, other than steroids, which take a few weeks to start, most of our non-steroidal immune suppressive drugs take 4 to 6 months to start working. Imuran may take 10 to 12 months to start working, to say nothing of maximum effect, which on average is around 18 months, but may be as long as 3 years, for instance, in some patients with azathioprine. Complement inhibition works within days. Complement inhibition is instantaneous with the administration of a complement inhibitor, and then the clinical effect will evolve over a very few days. Maximum response somewhere between 4 and 12 weeks, depending upon the individual patient, and then it is sustained. In addition, rather than the broad immunosuppressive effects and the associated off-target side effects that we see in some to many of our patients, These have very narrow adverse event profiles. Exceptionally well tolerated. Minor headache, some nausea, some nasopharyngitis with runny nose are the most common diarrhea with one of the other products that we have, but overwhelmingly a much safer class of drugs to use. Now, having said that, we must remember that complement inhibition increases the risk of bacterial infection from non-encapsulated bacteria, particularly meningococcus. And for that reason, patients must be vaccinated pertaining to your local community standards in the U.S. or wherever you are in the world with a quadrivalent vaccine and a B serotype vaccine, the latter if available in your particular country. And the current recommendations from the FDA state that one must be fully vaccinated before initiation of complement inhibitors. And there's some discussion as to what full immunization is. Typically, it's going to take 6 months. And therefore, one is going to have to consider, do I have time to wait before I initiate complement inhibitors, or do I treat them concurrently with antibiotics during the period of time until they are 2 weeks beyond their last appropriate vaccination? This has led to some clinicians stating, if I'm seeing someone with generalized myasthenia, maybe they should get all of their vaccinations up front so that we do not have to wait should we have the need to use them. And there are discussions and controversies regarding that, and there is no consensus at this point in time. But it's easy to say that complement inhibition as a new therapeutic works rapidly, relatively safe, can be administered either intravenously or with one preparation subcutaneously. Zilucoplan is a daily, once daily, subcutaneous injection that has been well tolerated by the patients that we have had under trial and now commercially available. All three are now commercially available.
Another one of our therapy classes for generalized myasthenia gravis are the FcRn inhibitors. Tell us about how those agents work and how effective they are.
The neonatal Fc receptor is not new. It's been around and recognized since the 50s. Sir Francis Bramwell's research was to identify that the transfer of maternal immunoglobulin to the fetus occurred through the neonatal Fc receptor, and that's how it got its name. It's the way there was transplacental transfer of immunoglobulin antibody to the fetus, so at birth, the neonate had an immune system. And then maternal immunoglobulin waned, the infant created its own immunoglobulin and its own immune system. It was quite by serendipity that Sally Ward and others identified that the FcRn, the neonatal Fc receptor, was ubiquitous. And it served as a salvage pathway, a transport mechanism for IgG and all subclasses of IgG to be taken out of the circulation, pinocytosed, binding very tightly to FcRn in an acidic environment, transported back to the cell surface, and re-released in circulation. They also demonstrated that that immunoglobulin, antibody or otherwise, that was not bound to the Fc receptor, that floated in the lysosome or floated in the endosome, got shunted to the lysosome for destruction. And so Sally Ward and colleagues, thinking about this, came up with a way to block the Fc receptor, and thereby increase the relative percent of immunoglobulin being shunted to the lysosome for destruction. And efgartigimod was born. Efgartigimod is a human IgG1 fragment that binds very tightly outcompetes IgG for the neonatal Fc receptor. And so treating individuals with this, we now have free-floating antibody to the acetylcholine receptor, for instance, in the endosome that is not bound, therefore gets taken to the lysosome and is destroyed. Very efficient, working very rapidly on the order of days, with maximum improvement occurring 3, 4, 5 weeks after dosing. There are a number of players in the market. Two have been approved. Efgartigimod was the first. The second was another antibody, rozanolixizumab, which is a full-size antibody. And a third, nipocalimab, has just finished clinical trials and then will go before the FDA and other regulatory bodies for approval in commercial use. The side effect profile, like our other targeted therapeutic class complement inhibitors, is very narrow. We see some headache, some nasopharyngitis, some diarrhea, and seemingly these are the most common. There is concern that could there be an increased risk for infection because we are depleting the circulating antibody from the system. I'm not convinced we have the whole data. Yes, there was a signal when we looked at the blinded phase of the trial that infection was increased over placebo. Yet when we went into the open label portion of the trial, that risk fell tremendously, an order of magnitude. So I don't think we have the full data. Clearly, I would not administer it during someone who has an active infection, of course, but I'm not so sure that it truly increases infectious risk. And plasma exchange data that we have shows that chronic plasma exchange in those individuals who are poor responders to other therapies, who are getting it multiple times through the month or every month, et cetera, have no increased risk of infection, a type of infection, bacteria, virus, et cetera. So that's a question that we still have to fully answer. Both of these classes produce substantial benefit in the overwhelming majority of patients, 60+% in both. And again, as I said, in a very rapid fashion over the course of days in a few weeks, as opposed to months and many months in time. Like all of these drugs, they must be continued to be efficacious with complement inhibitors every 2 weeks, every 8 weeks through intravenous infusion, or daily with subcutaneous administration. The FcRn inhibitors have been used in what was called a cyclical fashion, that patients were treated over a short period of time, observed for their clinical response, and retreated when they had the start of worsening symptomatology. With efgartigimod, the IV infusion taking a few minutes to administer once weekly for 4 weeks, and then observed, and as they started to deteriorate, retreat them. Efgartigimod also comes as a subcutaneous formulation, and there have been studies to show that it's dose equivalent to the IV preparation, and we see very similar clinical responses, over 60% achieving the primary endpoint, if you will, which was an improvement in the MG-ADL score and then sustained for a period of 4 weeks. The rozanolixizumab formulation is given by subcutaneous infusion. It requires a pump, and it's administered over a slightly longer period of time, weekly for 6 weeks, and then retreated as the patient deteriorates over time. Efgartigimod has recently completed a study looking at on a more chronic dosing interval, so loading the patient with weekly times four and then every 2 weeks. And these individuals who respond show a clear improvement that is sustained as long as the drug is administered.
So, with all these therapeutic options, how does one choose? Can you share with us best practices for determining what you're going to choose as initial therapy?
One of the biggest problems that we face is that myasthenia gravis has no therapeutic biomarker, much like our MS colleagues who use imaging to look at lesion burden in the brain. We aren't that fortunate. We have to rely on clinical response, clinical worsening to guide us. Yes, we have outcome measures that we use, the myasthenia gravis activities of daily living score, simply administered, gives us some insight. It's by no means perfect, but gives us some insight as to how someone is doing, may be a useful tool. But the decision as to which is better, who would respond better, we don't have answers to that. And unfortunately, our therapeutic advances have outstripped our basic science knowledge. And we have to go back and start to fill in the gaps to identify, are there subsets who will respond better to one versus the other? I think there's no question that someone has responded well to plasma exchange, to intravenous immunoglobulin, will respond quite nicely to a neonatal Fc receptor. I think how one chooses has to be a shared decision between the clinician and the patient, talking about what is the expectation in terms of response, what is the expectation in terms of adverse events, what logistics are needed to administer the product. I need a vaccination with complement inhibition. I do not need such with a neonatal Fc receptor. Neither of these classes require monitoring of the blood, unlike what we do with corticosteroids and for azathioprine and the cyclophilins, monitoring chemistries, renal function for diabetes, bone health, etc. None of that is needed with these two new classes. But I think how we choose is based on our experience, what we've become used to. I tend to gravitate to a complement inhibitor in those individuals who have failed multiple, failed is the wrong word, who have poorly responded to multiple therapies, because our data with the REGAIN study with eculizumab was done in a population of patients who had failed multiple therapeutics in the year previous, 2 years previous to study entry. And so one can feel comfortable that complement inhibition works there. That's not to say an FcRn inhibitor would not work. And in fact, many patients within the efgartigimod and rozanolixizumab trials, and I don't know the nipocalimab trial well enough in terms of data population, were those who would meet the same criteria as eculizumab, the REGAIN study. And then it comes down to cost. What is the insurance payer in the U.S. anyway? What are they going to pay for? Regrettably, many of our decisions are not fully ours and ours alone, but are impacted by the decisions of the insurance industry. And they may push us or force us to use a therapeutic A before therapeutic B, so that colors it. We're in the midst of revising the international guidelines for the treatment of myasthenia gravis. Probably within the year, they will be published. Extensive literature search, combing the data, trying to find clues, and then assimilating all that may help guide us once we finish that project. But at the moment, without question, it's a discussion with you and your patient. With all of these extraneous components in mind, can they come to an infusion center to get an IV infusion? Currently, the FcRns have to be administered by an HCP. I think that will change once there is a prefilled syringe, for instance, for the subcutaneous formulation of efgartigimod. But I have patients who want to have an IV infusion because it's a social venue for them. They tend to be my elderly population. They may be widowed, live alone, and this is an opportunity to have a social engagement. But I will tell you that there are others who are students, who are business people, who like to go on vacation and would prefer once a day subcutaneous injection. We have to keep in mind with our subcutaneous preparations, how are they stored? Is it room temperature or do they have to be cold packed? So this will also influence decision. The sum is that there is no one simple answer for everybody. Everyone is an individual. Remember, this is a snowflake disease. Each has its own nuances, not only in disease manifestations, but I think also in disease treatment. And so we need to listen to the patient. What are their expectations? How can we best make their quality of life better?
Thank you for your time. You are truly a pioneer in this area. Would you care to provide some closing remarks to our listeners?
Myasthenia gravis is in a revolution. And I think pharma has become interested in it, as I accused one CEO of a pharmaceutical company that your interest in this disease is because you can now pronounce the word myasthenia and spell it. And of course, he laughed. But there are innumerable clinical trials in development already in play right now with new technologies that are looking at various therapeutic options. How we treat myasthenia 10 or 15 years ago will no longer exist in 5 to 10 years. How we treat myasthenia gravis 15 to 20 years from now will not be the way we're treating myasthenia today in the next 5 to 10 years. We're in the midst of this evolution revolution. As individuals, companies, and research scientists unlock and unwrap the nuances of this disease in terms of how we can target very selectively. Consider, for an instance, we have the neonatal Fc receptor that globally removes circulating IgG. What if we could remove a specific antibody, only the MuSK antibody, only the AChR antibody, leave everything else intact? That's in play. It's under development. What happens if we had a compound, an oral compound, that will cleave your immunoglobulin molecule in two and render it useless and reduce circulating IgG by 80-90%? That's in play. It's coming. CAR T is a whole new venue, and there are multiple technologies there, autologous, allogeneic, DNA-based, messenger RNA-based. This is going to change landscape. And now we have companies interested in immune tolerance. Can we reset our immune system, recognize self, and the disease is gone? That's the Holy Grail. Who knows if it'll come to fruition? But people are thinking in this reign. This is an exciting time for the myasthenia world, not only for clinicians, but also for the patients and the benefits that we can bring to them.
Thank you for joining this Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast episode.